show of hands then to start off with. How many of you here today have ever read the book called Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe? It's a couple anyway. It's strongly recommended, even though it was written a long time ago. Like, I read it many years ago when I was a schoolboy, many, many years ago. But I decided to read it again more recently, and to my amazement, I found it to be very inspiring. Again, if you're looking for a good read, it is a super book. It's, there's adventure in there and everything. It's a work of pure fiction, and it was published way back in 1719. That's almost 300 years ago. Almost 300 years ago. But if the author, Daniel Defoe, were alive today, I would write to him and I would tell him that his famous novel helped me through some of the greatest trial periods of my life. So, how could a fictional book be so inspiring? Well, for those who are not familiar with the story, poor young Robinson Crusoe, again, is a young man, like many of you young men here today. He was in one of the most dreadful predicaments imaginable. He was shipwrecked on a desert island. He was a sole survivor of the wreck, and he literally doesn't know where on earth he is. He faces years of the most terrible dangers and trials, loneliness, tropical heat, storms, disease, fever. And to all of these problems, wild animals and cannibals want to have him over for lunch. During the course of the story, Robinson, writing in the first person singular in a diary format, goes through a very deep and meaningful self-examination and repentance. He begins to study his Bible. Again, he's only a young man, but he begins to study his Bible that he salvaged from the wrecked ship. He studies that Bible every day, and he quotes it very often in his diary. Not in a sugary or over emotional way, but very accurately and meaningfully. He talks to God in prayer, not just once a day, not just in a sleepy time prayer at night time, but almost constantly he's talking to God in prayer. And he learns to depend on God for his spiritual deliverance as well as for his physical deliverance from all of the tremendous dangers and problems that beset him. Now, two of the many scriptures that Robinson quotes in the story which affected and inspired me the most are these two. Please turn to Psalms, Psalm 50. Psalm 50. Psalm 50 and verse 15. Psalm 50 and verse 15. And call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. And the second of the two most inspiring scriptures to me is in Hebrews. All the way over to Hebrews, please, chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Verse 5. Let your conversation, and that's an old word for conduct, let your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And if you like a title to the sermon today, that's it. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Let me ask you, are you like the fictional Robinson Crusoe in some ways? Have you learned to trust in God for deliverance from dangers and trials, both physical and spiritual? I know that many of you are young people, but if you haven't had trials, if you haven't had dangers in your past already, then I can almost guarantee that sometime in the future you will. Have you learned to trust in God for deliverance from dangers and trials? Or do you think that God's miraculous protection somehow ceased after the death of the last New Testament personality? Like, that was then, this is now. Well, in the sermon today, I want to show you that God today is just as capable of miraculously protecting his people as he ever was. Now, let's go back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12. Because thousands of years ago, God made some great promises to Abraham. Promises of wealth, blessings, greatness, and protection. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. Now the Eternal had said unto Abraham, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you and curse him that curses you. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now later, the Lord, the Eternal, Yahweh, contacted Abraham again, and this time in human form as a king and a priest by the name of Melchizedek. Melchizedek, king of Salem. Let's go over to Genesis 14. Genesis chapter 14. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, Genesis 14 verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him, Abraham, and said, blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, talking about the Father there specifically, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abraham, gave Melchizedek tithes of all. Now, as we go through the book of Genesis, we find that the Lord Eternal repeated his blessings, his promises of blessings to Abraham over and over again. And now let's go over to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis 22. And this time, Abraham's name has been changed by God to Abraham. Abraham. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 17. That in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Why? Because you have obeyed my voice. Please remember that. Now these blessings were passed down from Abraham through his descendants, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob's sons, and especially Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, but the other sons of Jacob as well, and on down to the nation of Israel. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 14 now, going on along a few hundred years. Exodus chapter 14. Now during the Feast of Unleavened Bread every year, we read about the great miracles that God performed in Egypt and at the Red Sea in order to rescue his people from the Egyptians. We all know the story, and we've probably all seen the movie. But let's take another quick look at the Red Sea account in the context of God's physical protection and rescue. Exodus chapter 14 and verse 1. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal Zephon. Before it shall you encamp by the sea. And we believe that they were actually gone into a box canyon there, from what we understand. Verse 3. Now listen to this one and remember this one. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they're entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Please remember that verse. Jump down to verse 9. But the Egyptians pursued after them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Eternal. Verse 13. And Moses said unto the people, fear you not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord Eternal, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you shall see them again no more forever. Verse 14. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said unto Moses, why are you crying unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. Go forward. But lift you up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon his host, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them, and the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, to the Egyptians, but it gave light by night to these, to the Israelites, so that the one came not near the other all the night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch the Eternal looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Eternal fights for them against the Egyptians. So we all know what happened there. Fantastic miracles, to be sure. But we look at it and we say, well, that was more than, 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago. That was way back in Old Testament times, and we find it hard to identify with that. So we ask the question, can God still perform such miracles of physical protection in modern times? Does God still perform such wonderful miracles in modern times? Well, I'm going to tell you today, brethren, that yes, he can, he certainly can, and he certainly does. Now, I've had my own experiences, and I've heard or read wonderful first or second hand accounts of miraculous deliverances. I've heard about World War I, World War II, the Zulu Wars in Africa, in South Africa, and more recent conflicts where God has stepped in, obviously, to change the course of history. Today, I just have a few examples that I personally find very inspiring. And the first one is called A Miracle at Dunkirk. A Miracle at Dunkirk. Let's go back a little bit. After a long deferral, okay, after Israel came through the Red Sea, after a long deferral, and due to the great sins of Israel and Judah, God eventually began to fulfill his promises to Abraham and the other patriarchs, and he began to shower his wonderful blessings on their descendants. Beginning around the start of the 19th century. Now, there were blessings before that, but he really started to pour them out at the beginning of the 19th century. Now, fast forward here to 1940, in the late spring of 1940, and it appears that God had not yet finished with his blessings and his miraculous protection on the descendants of Israel. Now, the 1940 evacuation of the Allied forces from Dunkirk in northern France is still looked upon as a great miracle, even by secular historians. The British Prime Minister of the time, Winston Churchill, called what happened here a miracle of deliverance. And it contains some striking parallels with what we just read about God's evacuation of the Israelites through the Red Sea. So I want to read you a quote here, quite a long quote, from a subchapter called, and the subchapter is called A Miracle at Dunkirk, and it's from a book called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. Another good book to read is that one, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Okay, here we go. Ever since May the 20th, again this is 1940, ever since May the 20th when Guderian's tanks, and General Guderian was a German general now, broke through to Abbeville on the sea, again we're in northern France, the British Admiralty, on the personal orders of Churchill, had been rounding up shipping for a possible evacuation of the British expeditionary force that had gone over there to help the French and the Belgians. Okay, it's called a BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, and other Allied forces from the Channel ports. Non-combat personnel began to be ferried across the narrow sea to England at once. By May the 24th, the German armour striking up the coast from Abbeville after taking Boulogne and enveloping Calais had reached the Ar Canal, only 20 miles from Dunkirk. In between were caught the Belgian army, the 9 divisions of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, and 10 divisions of the French First Army. Though the terrain on the southern end of the pocket was bad tank country, being crisscrossed with canals, ditches, and flooded areas, Guderian's and Reinhardt's Panzer Corps already had 5 bridgeheads across the main barrier, the Ar Canal, between Vavelines on the sea and Saint-Omer, and were poised for the knockout blow which would hammer the Allied armies against the anvil of the advancing German 6th and 18th armies pushing down from the northeast and utterly destroy them. Suddenly, on the evening of May the 21st, came the peremptory order from the High Command, the German Nazi High Command, issued at the insistence of Hitler with the prompting of Rundstedt and Göring. But over the violent objections of Brauchitz and Holder that the tank forces should halt on the canal line and attempt no further advance. So Hitler commanded the tanks to stop when they were on the edge of victory. This furnished Lord Gort, who was the commander of the Allied forces, the British and the French and the Belgians, an unexpected and vital reprieve, which he and the British Navy and Air Force made the most of, and which, as Rundstedt later perceived and said, led to one of the great turning points in the war. How did this inexplicable stop order on the threshold of what seems certain to be the greatest German victory of the campaign come about? What were the reasons for it, and who was responsible? These questions have provoked one of the greatest arguments of the war among the German generals involved and among historians. Goering had intervened with Hitler. He offered to liquidate the entrapped enemy troops with his air force alone. It's called the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. The reasons for his ambitious and vain proposal were given the writer William Scheurer in a letter from Halder. Finally, on the evening of May the 26th, Hitler rescinded the stop order and the armoured forces resumed their advance on Dunkirk. But by then, it was late. The cornered enemy had had time to strengthen his defences, and behind them was beginning to slip away to sea. No more now than in all the years before did Hitler comprehend the character of the British nation, nor did he and his generals, ignorant of the sea as they were and remained, dream that the sea-minded British could evacuate a third of a million men from a small battered port and from the exposed beaches right under their noses. At 3 minutes before seven on the evening of May the 26th, shortly after Hitler's stop order had been cancelled, the British Admiralty signalled the beginning of Operation Dynamo, as the Dunkirk evacuation was called. That night, the German army resumed its attack on the port from the west and south, but now the panzers found it hard going and the tanks made little progress. I want to break in there and I just want to read you again how reminiscent this was of what we read in Exodus chapter 14, where it said, "It came to pass that in the morning watch the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire and cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Let's get back to the story. The tanks made little progress. Lord Gort had had time to deploy against them three infantry divisions with heavy artillery support. And in the meantime, the evacuation began. An armada of 850 vessels of all sizes, shapes and methods of propulsion, from cruisers and destroyers to small sailboats and Dutch scoots, many of them manned by civilian volunteers from the English coastal towns, converged on Dunkirk. Now listen to this, brethren. The first day, May the 27th, they took off 7,700 troops. The next day, 17,800. The following day, 47,300. And on May the 30th, 53,800, for a total of 126,600 during the first 4 days. This was far more than the British Admiralty, had hoped to get out. When the operation began, it counted on evacuating only about 45,000 men in the 2 days' time it then thought it would have. It was not until this fourth day of Operation Dynamo that the German High Command woke up to what was happening. For 4 days, the Nazi communiques had been reiterating that the encircled enemy armies were doomed. A Nazi communique of May the 29th stated flatly, "The British Army, which had been compressed into the..." Let me read that again. This is a quote from the communique. "The British Army, which has been compressed into the territory around Dunkirk, is going to its destruction before our concentric attack." And this is what we, again going back to Exodus 14, what we read in verses 1 to 3, I'll just read that. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon. Before it you shall encamp by the sea, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are entangled in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. And that's exactly what the Nazis were saying at that time. Let's go back again. Just repeating from William Shirer's book here. The Nazi communique of May the 29th stated, The British army, which has been compressed into the territory around Dunkirk, is going to its destruction before our concentric attack. But it wasn't. It was going to sea. With the certainty that the men would live to fight another day. May the 31st was the biggest day of all. Some 68,000 men were embarked for England, a third of them from the beaches and the rest from the Dunkirk harbour. A total of 194,620 men have now been taken out, more than four times the number originally hoped for. But where was the feigned Luftwaffe, the Nazi Air Force? Part of the time it was grounded because of bad weather. The rest of the time it encountered unexpected opposition from the British Royal Air Force, which from bases just across the channel successfully challenged it for the very first time. Though outnumbered, the new British Spitfires proved more than a match for the Messerschmitts. The Luftwaffe failed to achieve what Goring had promised Hitler, the annihilation of the British Expeditionary Force. On June the 1st, the second highest day's total was evacuated, 64,400 men. By dawn of the next day, only 4,000 British troops remained in the perimeter, protected by 100,000 French, who now manned the defences. The Luftwaffe at that time did not operate after dark, and during the nights of June the 2nd and 3rd, the remainder of the BEF and 60,000 French troops were successfully brought out. Dunkirk, still defended stubbornly by 40,000 French soldiers, held out until the morning of June the 4th. And by that day, 338,226 British and French soldiers had escaped the German clutches. A deliverance Dunkirk was to the British. Wow, say, what a rescue. Then again we ask the question, who stopped the tanks? Who stopped Guderian's tanks? The author of the book, William Shirer, after weighing the evidence and writing to some of the generals who were alive at the time, felt that the stop order originated with Hitler himself, influenced by Hermann Göring, who in his vanity wanted his Luftwaffe, of which he was the head, to get the glory of the victory rather than sharing it with the German army. So just like Israel's exodus from Egypt, the course of history was mightily changed through a colossal miracle from God, and through, as well, through human vanity. Again, we ask the question, did God harden Hitler's heart as he did Pharaoh's? One day we'll know, one day we'll find out. Okay, now, some of us might say, well, that Dunkirk episode was 73 years ago. I wasn't even born then. My grandfather wasn't even born then. But we ask the question then, has God protected or delivered the descendants of physical Israel in more recent years? Or, again, has he now cut off our nations from his protection because of our sins, our national and personal sins? Please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 17. If you shall say in your heart, These nations are more than I, how can I dispossess them You shall not be afraid of them, but shall well remember what the Eternal your God did unto Pharaoh and unto all Egypt. Coming closer in time, 38 years after World War II, just 30 years ago from now, back in 1983, Britain, again one of the major nations of modern Israel, found it necessary to do some military dispossessing of their own when Argentina invaded the British-owned Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic Ocean. If God had delivered the Brits from a type of modern Egypt, if God had delivered Britain from a major power like Nazi Germany, could he deliver them from a relatively minor power like Argentina? Or was that all finished with? Continue in verse 19. The great temptations or trials which your eyes saw, and the signs and wonders, and the mighty hand, and the stretched out arm, whereby the Eternal your God brought you out, so shall the Eternal your God do unto all the people of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Eternal your God will send the hornet among them, until they that are left and hide themselves from you be destroyed. You shall not be affrighted at them, for the Eternal your God is among you, a mighty God and a terrible. And the Eternal your God will put out those nations before you by little and little. You shall not consume them all at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon you. And for God's own good reasons, he says that he'll make the physical Israelites work a little bit for some of their victories, which is exactly what happened. Verse 23, but the Eternal your God shall deliver them unto you, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. And he shall deliver their kings into your hands, and you shall destroy their name from under heaven. There shall no man be able to stand before you until you have destroyed them. Now again, talking about this Britain's short war with Argentina, this brief war captured the attention of the world at the time, and much has been written about it. There's a whole book actually called The Falklands Miracle, which deals especially with the incredibly, incredibly good luck, as a lot of people look at it, that Britain experienced at many different times during the short conflict. If you can get your hands on a copy of that book, it's worth a read. I'll just give you a couple of examples here. The first one, when there was a major battle going on for the capital of the Falkland Islands, that's called Port Stanley, and at the very time that the Argentine army surrendered in that battle, the British were almost completely out of ammunition. And if the Argentinians had not surrendered at precisely that time, the British army would have had to retreat. That would have prolonged the conflict, further loss of life, possibly even reversing the final outcome of that war. Now the second example I have is not from that book. It's another account of a miracle that took place, and it comes not from that book, but rather from a nephew of mine who lives in England and was in the British Army at the time. He lives close to my brother in Liverpool in England. Well, this nephew was serving in the British Army at the time, and after some special training, he embarked with thousands of his comrades aboard a luxury P&O liner called the Canberra, which had been hurriedly converted into a troop ship. They left England, and as they steamed into the South Atlantic, their floating home came under severe attack by the Argentinian jet fighters. They attacked one side of the Canberra with missiles. They peeled off and then came back round again, and concentrating their fire on the same side of the ship. although the missiles did explode, the explosions failed to penetrate the ship's hull. Now the soldiers who were watching, and obviously somewhat fearfully, no doubt, reported that the explosions seemed to merely bounce off the hull and inflicted little or no damage. Now why was that? On a later investigation, it was discovered that when the Canberra was first built back in the 1960s at the Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast, there was an unacceptable twist in the hull. Not sure why, but it could have been because of different steel densities or something like that, I don't know. But this twist threw off the whole balance and design of the ship. And the only way to correct it was to add more weight to one side of the hull. And the weight that was provided, the weight that was needed was provided by lining that side of the hull with a couple of inches of reinforced concrete. So 20 years before that conflict, God knew what was going to happen. Now many such accounts could be told of God's miraculous deliverance of modern physical Israelites, and time doesn't allow today. I've heard various ones that would be just send shivers up your spine when you listen to them, that I've heard from brethren over the years. But despite many national and personal sins, the physical descendants of Israel have been miraculously protected and delivered, again by God's mercy, and in order to fulfill his promises to Abraham. But we know, brethren, that one day, and perhaps soon, we don't know the time, the day or the hour, that just like ancient Israel, the blessings of protection and deliverance will be taken away from our beloved nations. And probably for the same reasons as with ancient Israel and Judah, and that is due to disobedience, through to idolatry, and through Sabbath breaking. But what about spiritual Israel? What about God's true church? What about you, and what about me? Does God protect us? Do his promises of deliverance and protection, both physical and spiritual, apply to us too? Well, we can have confidence that yes, they do. One instance comes immediately to mind when I think about these times. I'm going to tell you about this one. This one takes me back to a cold winter's night in Ontario some years ago. One of our ministers, I'm not talking about myself, but his name was John. One cold winter's night in Ontario some years ago, when John, this minister, fell asleep at the wheel of his car while driving home after a particularly exhausting day, and his wife was also dozing in the car. All of a sudden, both of them, John and his wife, heard a loud, clear voice shout, "John!" and woke them both instantly, thus averting a possibly dreadful crash. John stopped the car, he got out to clear his head and to get some fresh air, and he retraced the car's tire tracks in the snow on the side of the road for a short distance. The tracks disappeared as they approached the side of the road, and then reappeared again a few yards further down, and they should have crashed into a deep roadside ditch. Who did that? I hadn't planned to tell you about this one, but I was reading over my notes this morning, and going back a couple of years ago, I used to work for BCTEL and TELUS, and I was working up in Port Hardy, and during the winter I had to drive back down to Campbell River to meet some guys to do some other work. And there's a small there's a it's not really a high mountain range, but those of you who know it, there's a mountain range that runs between Hardy and Campbell River. And I looked on the internet to see if what the weather forecast was like. Looked good in Hardy, looked good in Campbell River. Didn't know in between. Anyway, so I started driving down. I got my van with all my gear in the back, still quite light. I'm driving down there, and as I go through Port McNeil and start going uphill after Port McNeil, I see the snow, the rain starting to change to snow. And so I thought, well, I'll keep going, I'll be all right. So I kept going, climbing. The snow is getting thicker and thicker, and there's more traffic in there. And you can see the state of the road was pretty horrible. And when I got to the top of this, ridge, and it was like glazed ice up there. And I'm going dead slow, but then I felt the rear end of the truck start to fishtail. And the next thing, I'm going round in circles, and then down off the side of the road, down this, there was a mountain over here. I'm on a mountainside here, and I end up going backwards right down. I'm going pretty fast, down this hillside. And then I thought, this is it, it's game over. And then suddenly it straightened out, and the van came to a stop. I bumped into a deadhead, a log stump right there. And I sat there, and my van wasn't damaged very much, bit of a bump in the back there, but I'm sitting there and I think, what am I going to do? I'm way down at the bottom of this ravine. And that's why, I'll phone for a tow truck. Get my cell phone right up in the mountains. No signal there, right? The stupid cell service, you know. And I'm sitting down there. What am I going to do? So I sat there and I thought, I'm going to pray. That's the first thing I'm going to do. So I sat there and I prayed. Because I'm down at the bottom of this ravine, the road is way up there, and everything's covered in snow. So there's no way. The only way I can get up is go up there, and try and get a ride into town or something like that. Okay, I'll just give it a try and see if I can get the van up there. I didn't think there was any chance, really. So I prayed about it, switched the van on, and started to move. And I got it, and it went ever so slowly, slip, but I eventually got back up onto the road and into safety. And, going back there in recent years and looking down there, I can only say that it was a true miracle that I was able to get out of there and that I survived. If the terrain wouldn't have straightened around, I would have gone way down and I would have been dead meat. Wouldn't be here today. Let's put you all to sleep. Okay, so again, many will be able to recount similar accounts. And they're always inspiring to read, they're always inspiring to listen to. But really, brethren, why should we be surprised at such things? Because God has given us a solid, although conditional, promise of protection. Conditional? Yes, conditional. Let's go over to Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. We're going to read the words that God spoke to Joshua before he led the Israelites into the promised land. And these words also can apply to you and me. Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Eternal, it came to pass that the Eternal, Yahweh, spoke unto Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, jump down to verse 5. There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you. I can read there. I will not leave you, nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land which I swore unto their fathers to give them. Brethren, do you want God to be with you? Do you want God not to leave or forsake you? Again, times will come where you will have trials and dangers, and you'll be wanting God to be there for you. Verse 7, only be you strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law. Because this is the conditions now. He gave the promise, and here in verse 7 on, he's given his conditions. Only be you strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night. Remember Robinson Crusoe? Meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Do you want to be prosperous? Do you want to have good success? And here's the conditions here that God gives. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be you dismayed. For the eternal your God is with you wherever you go. Wonderful, wonderful promise, brethren. But again, you say, aren't these, all of these that we've read so far, are they not Old Testament promises and commands? Well, yes, they are. But some of these words, many of these words, are repeated in the New Testament for you and me, for the New Testament Church of God. Let's go and repeat that one again back in Hebrews chapter 13 that we read at the beginning there. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation or conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he, and he's talking about God, the Lord or Yahweh, has said, I will never leave you, nor forsake you. Again, the related Old Testament commands and promises are applied right here to New Testament Christians and to us today. Verse 6, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do to me. Remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God. I believe that's talking about ministers in that respect. Whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation or conduct, or like the end product or the end result of their conduct. So it's okay, it's good to follow the examples of ministers as long as their examples are good ones. Okay, as long as they preach God's word faithfully and accurately, and as long as they are faithful to God and to his word, that's important. So before we move away from here, let's ask the question, are the Lord's promises and commands so very different between the Old Testament and the New Testament? Let's read verse 8. Verse 8. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. Please don't forget that verse. That's very important. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. One more promise in this regard for today. One more scripture, one more promise. Let's go all the way over to Revelation. All the way over to Revelation. Just one verse here. Revelation chapter 3. and verse 10. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. And again, there's a condition and a promise. Before we had a promise and a condition. Now we've got condition and a promise. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Because you have kept the word of my patience, that's the condition, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation or trial, which shall come upon all the world to try them who dwell upon the earth. Now, so if we emulate this obedient and persevering attitude of the Philadelphia church that's being described here, God promises protection from this future worldwide time of severe trial. That's going to be the biggie. I think we've got trials now. We ain't seen nothing yet. So brethren, we can have the fullest confidence. We can have the fullest confidence, despite the tests and trials that we will go through, that the Lord God will give us his divine protection when we need it. Like Joshua, like the members of the early church, we too should be strong and of good courage. Remember that. Be strong and of good courage no matter what you go through. And if we will follow the good examples of God's true and faithful servants, both past and present, if we will remain content with the blessings that God has given us, and if we will continue to worship him, obey him, and serve him as he commands, brethren, he will never leave us. He will never forsake us.